Welcome to the Donnybrook Podcast. I'm your host, David.
I'm Amanda.
Hi. Good morning. This is John.
Hey,
or afternoon,
it's John.
Or evening, whenever you're listening.
Well, this is our...
middle of the night.
Yeah.
Second breakfast.
Second breakfast, I like that. This is our last recording in our old studio here down at the church. We have new sound equipment coming, and we're going to be moving into our new studio for the next podcast recording.
Which hopefully won't be a month after this one.
Yeah,
like...
hopefully we'll have more regularity with the...
we'll
the
see.
Use of...
can we start doing this every week? I hope we can.
I that's setting your standard awfully high. I don't know.
Well, let's set it at every week, and then if we do every 2 weeks, maybe we can make that work. Oh, it's going to be fun, though.
If we set it once a month and then do it every 2 weeks, then we'll feel good about ourselves. If we set it every week and then do it only every other week, then... right?
Yeah.
Like, let's undersell.
Okay. Well, we'll see you again in a couple months.
Great. Great. We'll see you guys after recess, we don't balance the budget again and then go on a 2 month recess to talk to our voters.
Yeah.
Isn't that how you're supposed to do it in politics?
I think so.
Okay.
And we are
an emergency budget.
Anything if we're a political podcast.
Very, very
okay,
political.
Fine. I won't bring that up. Sorry.
Yeah, you hurt my feelings. I don't think we can talk about politics. Or religion. I mean, what else is there to talk about? I know. We could talk about Bitcoin.
Yeah, perfect.
Investments, money.
That's, money. That, there that's we go.
A, not that's, controversial
or not
at
money.
All.
That's not Bitcoin. Non-money?
David, you were telling me about Bitcoin this week. David, so I go over to David's house over the weekend, and David says to me, can I say this advice? Is this legal to say this advice?
I'll say it.
You say it.
I said, please buy $100 of cryptocurrency. Please. It's young. This is a great time to buy. Please, just put $100 in now and look at it in a couple of years.
So I bought $100 of, I'm blanking. Ethereum? Illyrium.
Ethereum. No, Ethereum. You got it right.
Ethereum
the first time.
The first time. And I bought, so David walked me through setting up an account and I bought it and it promptly the next day dropped 30% of its value, immediately. So I called David that afternoon. And again, I invested a whole $100. So I didn't go into this with some expectation. I didn't go take my 401k out and drop it in there. So it wasn't like I was sweating bullets, but I called David up and said, so financial advisor, how you feeling today?
and I said, oh, this is a great time to buy because Bitcoin had just crashed that morning. It went, I mean, it had lost like 30% in the last 24 hours and it had gone down and it was so low. And I looked at it at like 8 a.m. in the morning and it was down just like way, way low.
And it didn't come all the way back, but it's back.
It's really
close. Almost back.
And I said, oh, I should really put some money in right now because this is a really good deal right now. And I just thought, well, maybe I'll do it this afternoon. We'll see how it went. Just, of course, you know, it went, came right back up.
Yeah.
It was a great buying opportunity.
The money you could have made if you had taken your own advice.
Right.
Oh, well. Oh, well. I still like the idea though. I'm going to keep my eyes on it. If there's another big crash, I may
drop another 100 in.
May drop another 100 in and then I'm going to be done.
Amanda, have you put, $100 in Bitcoin?
No, I did get that, same speech.
You got it from Dave.
Oh yeah.
You didn't
yeah.
listen to him though.
Well, I'm just lazy and distracted and have a million other things on my mind.
Hey, so. I have a computer right here. So while we're talking, I want you to sign up for your account.
Get that money in right now.
That's right.
Get that money in. He's trying to boost back the percentage points
right,
that
increasing
he lost
demand.
The other day. Yeah.
No, but
he does sound like a financial advisor,
yeah,
doesn't he?
Seriously though, I think that it would be great to just put $100 and just so you have a little foot in the door with cryptocurrency because it's an exciting.
Well, you believe in the technology.
I do. I think the technology is really exciting. It's got some really interesting potential.
And here's where I can sound smart and say blockchain, even though I don't understand what that means.
David's laughing. David's snickering over here.
She gets points for brilliance here.
I I know that cryptocurrency comes from the dark web, and therefore it's evil, and probably...
Yeah, probably David's using it to buy something horrible.
Well, or like, I'm thinking more like shaman... occult.
Dark web.
Dark web.
As
occult.
In dark magic.
Yes,
as
dark
in,
magic.
Well, yeah. I've long said that what David does is voodoo of some sort.
I have been trying. This is almost sacrilegious. I will make my admission in front of you both. I bought a collection of stories by H.P. Lovecraft.
As one does.
Back in November, I think. I've never read The Call of Cthulhu. Mm-hmm. And I am stuck halfway through it. And every time I pick it up, a kid walks into the room or somebody needs to chat or I just am exhausted and read a page and fall asleep. And, and I was reminded of that because there's all these references to the occult and mm-hmm. dark things going on. So my point in all that is, how do you know that Bitcoin wasn't developed by Cthulhu?
Who's H.P. Lovecraft?
Oh my goodness. No. Are you serious?
I have actually, because I was at Costco the other day and I was looking at classic books and I saw this book by H.P. Lovecraft and I thought, I feel like maybe I heard John talking about H.P. Lovecraft the other day. This is a really interesting name, but I have no idea who he is. I didn't Google it, and I think I should be better on the podcast about saying, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Okay,
so on the behalf of our listeners who have no idea who H.P. Lovecraft is, myself included, in the heck is H.P. Lovecraft?
No. There's more people than one that don't know who H.P. Lovecraft is.
I'm going on the probabilities that we have two listeners.
We have two listeners.
And one doesn't know who H.P. Lovecraft is.
I'll bet you, even within relatively well-read circles, like David's well-read. David is not your standard person. So I
my frame of reference is so skewed. It's ridiculous.
No, I didn't know who H.P. Lovecraft was until a couple of years ago. So
I need to put that on my Twitter profile. David is not your standard person. I like that. That's a good tagline.
Weren't you talking about writing up like a bio for your job?
Oh yeah, there we go.
And it was horrible, and I was giving you good advice on how to make it more horrible.
how did you intentionally describe it badly.
So here's the deal. At my job.
This is so bad.
We're working on a. Let me see if I can pull it up here. At my job, we're working on a new website. We're working on a new,
social media,
like an about page where we have the team members.
Okay, just a short, your basic about you.
Short
page.
Bio.
Okay.
And
this is the point where somebody says,
I must have
David lives in Boise, has five beautiful children.
Yeah, exactly.
You know.
So, you know, you're kind of standard thing. Yeah. And I'm trying to figure out.
Like anything that tastes stronger than vanilla.
That's right.
Ooh, that's a good one too.
That's also a very good
one. I was
trying your standard
to
person.
Figure out kind of a way
of trying to
something to be funny.
Differentiate or.
Where did I? Maybe I wrote it over here. Let's see.
So right now at this point, if Amanda and I get to write your bio, it would be David, not your standard person, pretty much only likes the flavor vanilla and doesn't know who H.P. Lovecraft is.
That's what we're going with.
There
at this
is
point.
Your new bio. You don't even need to tell us what you were thinking about doing.
I like it. I think this is a great bio.
In all I remember from it was something about. A dog, and I was like, why would you write about your dog just died?
Your dead dog?
How morbid is that?
Oh, come on. Okay, so I said, David lives in Boise, Idaho with his wife and five kids.
And the corpse of his dead dog.
Mummified.
Now we're on H.P. Lovecraft territory.
Yeah, we're moving.
He likes to eat bacon. See, this is good. He likes to eat bacon.
That's
pat dogs on the head. Alive
See,
dogs.
That was the morbid part.
He enjoys reminiscing about the good old days of floppy disks and dial-up internet and encouraging today's generation to get off his lawn.
I heard that and I thought, David is 84 years old.
That's what I heard.
Is it too grumpy?
Oh, way too grumpy.
Way too curmudgeonly?
Way too curmudgeonly.
Okay.
You sound like a boomer who thinks he's an Xer.
Where I'm really just almost not really even an Xer.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, H.P. Lovecraft. We need to educate our audience.
You go.
Okay. Early 20th century American writer.
Yep.
Writes horror. And is an innovator in the horror genre.
But when you say horror, it's like literary horror.
Extremely literary horror.
Along the lines of,
although he also wrote some fairly pulpy stuff.
Sure, sure, sure.
But he was such an innovator that his, so he's not actually a great, great writer. He's engaging and interesting, but he isn't, he doesn't write extremely finely crafted prose. However, there is no one who has ever written who has his imagination for the truly horrifying and horrific. So you read horror and it's like, oh, the dead dog became possessed by a demon and walked around and it's scary.
Yeah.
H.P. Lovecraft writes.
Like ratchets that up. Another 2 degrees real quick.
Real quick. And creepy and strange, but then underpinning the creepy and the strange is this ability to imagine great evil. And so Call of Cthulhu is his best known story. And it spawned an entire literary genre of its own. The Cthulhu mythos is written in by most sci-fi and fantasy authors. There are short story contributions and novel contributions to the Cthulhu mythos from just, I don't know, dozens of sci-fi and fantasy writers. And, of course, the premise of the Call of Cthulhu is that Earth is inhabited by the Great Old Ones.
Mm-hmm. I'm that far in.
And Great Old Ones... Even just, I mean, that phrase, the Great Old Ones, alien beings of awful terror.
Demonic.
Yes.
Demigods.
Yeah, demigods. Holy wicked demigods who are utterly indifferent to humanity. And it's that mood of indifference to humanity that I think carries so much horror in it. So Call of Cthulhu.
And it's fun to read. And so yeah, of all that.
It is. It's
after
fun
saying
to read.
All that, it's actually, it's really good. Like you... I'm surprised, having read a couple of things by him, I'm surprised that there aren't major motion pictures. Like, At the Mountains of Madness, which is what the one I most recently read, I cannot believe that has not been made into a movie. It feels like Independence Day. I got done reading it and I was like, I think that the producers of Independence Day must have read this and drawn, like, ideas from it.
Right. So but his mood of stark... I don't know, darkness is something that probably wouldn't make a blockbuster, but definitely scare you to death.
Well, sounds like it could be a pretty good blockbuster. Okay. So whenever I hear of a really compelling story, it always has its roots in reality. It has its roots in our world. And when you said, you know, the Great Old Ones, it makes me think of the Greek gods and where probably the Greek gods came from, which was the sons of God that
looked upon the daughters of men.
Yeah. And these kind of angelic, powerful beings that were spawned the Nephilim. Is that the kind of,
and eventually developed the dark web, which brought us Bitcoin and we have come completely
full circle.
Full circle.
The end. Thank you. Good night.
That is right. Next week, we'll be back.
Is that kind of what he's playing on? That kind of feel?
He's playing on a large number of things. That, I think, is definitely a contributor. Of course, at that time in American history, mysticism is fairly popular. Beginning in the late Victorian era, the talking to the beyond, spiritualism was very big. As you see in Connie Willis's To Say Nothing of the Dog, which you should also all read.
To Say Nothing of the Dog?
Yes. To Say Nothing of the Dog. You would like that. The dog's alive.
The short story.
And so there is that interest in spiritualism and mysticism, which often ended with people getting spooked by their own investigations. combine that with Northern American awareness, growing Northern American awareness with the cultic subcultures of Creole, the Creole South. So Louisiana, the island nations, this would lead into a much larger discussion if you guys let me get away with
it. Lovecraft's complicated because there's a lot of, there's these very racist.
Oh, deeply.
Very much. And that whole, like the whole, if you've studied like Teddy Roosevelt and you know, that era, it's the same era. And so you'll be reading along on Teddy Roosevelt and then he'll say something that's incredibly like, whoa, what's this about the super race? Like, where did that just get slipped in? Lovecraft's right in the middle of all that craziness and stuff. So.
And one of the, a significant component of that, and this is just connecting now in my head, that the white conception of Haiti as an independent entity is very much tied with the
Trump reference. Well, right there.
No, I did. I was Trump. What?
Well, Haiti's close enough to all those other
one
nations.
Of those, you know, something.
Yeah, exactly.
Something nations. Yeah,
sorry.
Yeah.
Okay,
no,
go ahead.
Haiti.
Things
has,
haven't moved very far, I guess, from H.P. Lovecraft till now.
So maybe it is Trump that prompted this because I read an article and then now I'm reading a book that's talking about how the white consciousness needs Haiti to fail. Because Haiti is the place where the slaves revolted and overthrew their white masters and took control. And so
But back to H.P. Lovecraft. Sorry, so I totally derailed you.
Haitian spirituality, Haitian culture, and white conceptions of Haitian culture, especially white judgment of Haitian culture as subhuman, is in Lovecraft's mythos. He's drawing on the worst stereotypes that white culture had of the Haitian people as being illiterate, irresponsible, and devil worshiping and willing to call forth evil powers. And that of course ties into Trump's comment, because of the narration of Haitian culture in white culture is very much tied to that they have to fail because they overthrew their white masters and started the whole, hey, we can't own slaves anymore thing.
So, I mean, just to kind of finish up the Lovecraft thing, the quote that was at the beginning of the book when I read that, I now that I'm older, I'm reading introductions. Do you remember? I never read introductions, but now I'm reading introductions. And in the beginning.
And the poetry at the beginning of the
Oh, I've always
chapters.
Read that.
Okay.
I've always read that. But the quote, and this is a pretty famous quote by Lovecraft, but the oldest and strongest emotion of mankind is fear. And the oldest and strongest kind of fear is the fear of the unknown. And he definitely plays on that because often things are, as he writes, it's not revealed. Yeah. You keeps on playing
the master
that out
of.
And lets your imagination kind of run away with it. And it's beautiful. And
it sounds like a movie. It really does.
It really is. It's really
brilliant. It's not, though. It's
an
epistolary novel. So.
What does epistolary mean?
Told in letters.
Dracula.
Yes. Or The Haunted Bookshop.
The Haunted Bookshop.
No, it's not
letters.
The Haunted Bookshop. It's the other one that's told in letters. Never mind. Sorry.
Oh, the first one?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I don't think I read that one. Okay. I was gonna, but.
Silence.
It wasn't as good.
Is Silence told in letters too?
Yes.
Okay.
Which is another book I'm trying to get through right now.
How about the New Testament?
well, that was all made up by people thousands of years after Jesus actually lived on the earth. So,
in order to control and manipulate.
Control and manipulate.
Yeah,
that's right.
I heard that somewhere once.
All right. So, interestingly enough, this kind of dovetails into what I wanted to talk about because we just had Martin Luther King Jr. Day. And we all read an article by an author named Jamar Tisby, who was writing about the adoption of Martin Luther King Jr.
And who also has a superior podcast if you want to listen to something better.
Very good.
Pass the mic.
Pass the mic is his podcast, and he's at the head of an organization called
The Witness.
The Witness, yes.
Yeah.
Amanda, do you listen to that podcast?
I have listened to part of an episode. I don't listen to podcasts.
I know. I didn't think you listened to any podcasts at all.
Jamar Tisby's tweets, because, you know, I don't like to read too many words if I don't have to, and articles. And then there's another podcast that I have listened to that he recommended called Truth's Table. And yeah, it's just a network of good ideas and yeah.
So anyway, I read an article by him, that was written for the Washington Post called Why So Many White Churches Resisted Martin Luther King Jr.'s Call. And it's a fascinating article. We can't get into all of it, but the three of us all read it. And I'm just curious what your guys is, just what was your feeling? 'Cause we're all very much, whether we like it or we don't, we all very clearly fall into white
evangelical
evangelical, grew up more or less in that culture, that subculture,
in the whitest state in the union.
Why
don't you kind of lay out in a paragraph what the article's saying?
I don't know if I can do it justice. It's such a complicated thing.
Well, I think the first idea to think about is just his premise for the article, that Martin Luther King Jr. was rejected by white churches during his activism.
When he was alive, he was rejected.
Yes.
But now today,
he's valorized.
He is.
And I think I read there were Barna surveys of his approval rating taken during the height of his activism, and his approval rating was 33%. And then recent surveys say the approval rating of his work is at 95%. And that's a huge shift.
So the interesting point where the article really turns is, and I'm reading from it right now, King saw a link between Christian faith and the responsibility to change unjust laws and policies. But his emphasis on the social dimensions of Christianity, especially regarding race relations, angered many white evangelicals of his day. And it kind of goes, it says that they tended to believe that the government should force people to, shouldn't be the one to force people to integrate, that wasn't the government's job. And he goes on to point out, let me find it in the article, to King, many white evangelicals agreed with King's affirmation of racial equality. They may have believed all people should be treated fairly. They objected to the notion that government should play a role bringing about equality, that the Christian should concern themselves with material issues rather than simply focusing on conversion. And the point he kind of makes here that I think is so interesting is that the tendency within the white evangelical church is to focus on the individual rather than the group.
Right.
And that we look at each other, at ourselves and each other as individuals, and we're like, well, I personally should be treated with equality and respect. And you, as an individual, should be treated with equality and respect. So, of course, I believe in this idea that every person should be treated with equality and respect.
But this resistance to the idea of identifying the difference in the way groups are treated and trying to address that,
right,
politically, socially, or theologically.
Right. And or even recognizing that races have been either elevated or devalued historically. And that you actually have to take action at a race level, not just at an individual level or at a group level or a subgroup level to affect policy change. That was the piece that the white evangelical church rejected. And when I read that, I went, yeah, that sounds right. That sounds like the kind of pushback that I remember, within my white evangelical context, I know that for myself, like, I pushed back very hard, even until very recently, within the last couple of years, against I'm blanking on the term. What is it that we do at the collegiate level?
Oh, the Title 15 or something?
Title IX.
Yeah, yeah, where we're constantly trying to make sure everything's even instead of basing things off of merit alone. But there were, that we've gone, we, equal opportunity is what I'm trying to think. I was on the tip of my tongue the whole time. and where we are, in a sense, giving special privileges or more opportunities to people who, come from
the disadvantaged groups
to disadvantaged groups. Sure. And that I know that I grew up in an environment where I very much was like, well, that's the exact wrong way of handling it. If everybody's going to be treated fairly at an individual level, then
you can't have anything like affirmative action.
We wouldn't have anything like affirmative action or equal opportunity or Title IX or any of that.
I assume that you also, David, but I definitely heard that many times growing up.
Well, I did just hear it. I'm owning it more than that. I thought it. I felt it. I agreed with that.
Okay.
You obviously were more informed than
I
was.
No, I don't know about that. I don't know how clearly I formulated my thoughts on it until later. Like as a, yeah, I'm not sure where it was that I started to really consider that or think about that. But of course, you know, I said Title IX and you talked about equal opportunity
and affirmative action.
Yeah. Right. And I come from historically the second most privileged group in our nation, but I am.
Is the first most privileged group white males?
And the second most is white women. Females? Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, that's not really a position of great, oppression or identification with oppression, but it is at least a step removed from a position of greatest privilege. And so I think from that perspective, I readily saw that it's not an issue of giving, you know, extra advantages to a group of people because we want them to succeed more. It's about trying to balance out the system that's rigged already in someone else's favor. So that equal opportunity or affirmative action isn't about introducing an element of unfairness. It's about trying to introduce fairness into an inherently and systemically unfair system.
But the piece of it that I think Tisby nails is the criticism that the emphasis within the white evangelical community is on individual fairness rather than on this bigger, broader question of disadvantaged groups,
right,
and race,
right,
and how all of those things interact with each other. And I, again, like until very recently, I completely missed that. David, what was your experience growing up? I mean, does any of this resonate with you at all, or?
Well, I grew up, in that same climate, mm-hmm. You're very conservative and, you grew up in the church. So what I'm wondering, like the question that comes to mind as you're saying this is, if everybody in the church takes that individual mandate seriously, mm-hmm. to treat individuals well and fairly and lives that out in their everyday life, doesn't that end up with us having treating people?
No group ends up marginalized because everybody's.
As far as the church goes, as far as we go, as far as the church as a whole.
Okay, so this is probably, I don't know if I should even start. I'm reading a really great book now. Shocking. And it's by Willie Jennings, and it's called The Christian Imagination, Theology and the Origins of Race. And it gets into the historical beginning of the entire concept of race. So, John, you said race a couple of times, and I think, you know, we all know what we mean by race. But one of the things that I think is hard for us to imagine is that race as a concept did not exist prior to the African slave trade. So no one had a concept of whiteness or blackness. And so I teach ancient history and literature, and in the ancient world, you have a very what we would call a mixed race society, but no one thinks about it in terms of anyone's race or racial identity. That's not even a concept that could be conceived of. And so the idea of
So I'm hearing you, and I'm willing to let you go, continue going. But like that premise just doesn't even like I don't agree with that premise on a whole bunch of levels. So
that that the concept of race didn't exist.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, if for no other reason, we see the Jews historically are oppressed because of
the tribal identity.
Just read Ivanhoe and
Donnybrook.
It's a tribal identity, not a racial identity.
Okay.
So anyone can be Jewish.
It's the same. It's the and same anyone can anyone treatment. Can,
well,
it's the same.
It's not like you don't have conflict between people groups prior to the concept of race. Of course you do. You have the Greeks versus the Persians. I mean, those barbarians. You have, yes, people against the Jews against other people groups.
But these are nations against nations.
They're nations and or tribes.
Sure.
And they're identified by culture and not by physical appearance in the way that we identify races. So how many races are there in the world? Like, if you were to just say, okay, so we have the white race, we have the Asian race, and we have the black race. Those are concepts that did not exist in the ancient world.
So obviously you're reading a book, and I'm sure it's well researched, and I'm sure he's not just throwing stuff out there abstractly.
Well, this idea didn't come from the book. This idea came from other things.
So just if I'm just shooting from the hip and just thinking, every what you want to call them race or tribe or whatever, you find all kinds of examples throughout history where people talk about how they are genetically superior to everybody else. You see, this is a concept that seems pretty prevalent through
the idea of groups thinking that they're superior to other groups.
Yes,
yes, but the distinction I'm making is that the concept of racial identity is very distinct from the concept of tribal identity or even national identity. So what defines race?
Okay, so yeah, maybe we're getting a little bit into semantics and we don't need to do that. So go ahead, continue.
Okay, so the idea of white people as a group was essentially invented by the Europeans as they began the slave trade. So you read some of the early documents, the early accounts of slaves being brought to Europe and being introduced to Europe. And they're described in terms of their likeness or unlikeness to white people. And prior to the slave trade, the idea of white people does not appear, whiteness as a group identity. You certainly have people who identify as French or as Spanish or as English, mm-hmm. and they're white. Mm-hmm. But the idea of their whiteness, the color of their skin being a defining part of their identity, does not occur prior to that historically.
Okay.
So all of this to say, if we were to go with David's concept of, and I think it's not an unreasonable way to formulate things, like if we all love one another well, according to Christian principles of loving our neighbor as ourselves, and we are all doing that, we won't see racial division in the church, but we aren't starting from a blank slate and we aren't capable of loving one another as we ought to.
Sure.
So we as white evangelicals, as white Christians, are strongly identified with our history, the historical pattern of white Christians kidnapping Africans, carrying them away from their homeland and telling them that this was a blessing for them because now they had the opportunity to become Christians. And if they became Christians, they'd make better slaves. And so if we're going to even talk about how our individual choices and the way we individually treat other people will make a difference, we actually have to grapple with the communal sin. The sin that the church participated in, the church was identified with. And so I guess, I don't know, I probably didn't need to get into all of that. And David can edit it out later. But I think the big idea there is that there were individual sins committed all along the way that we got mm-hmm. to this point. Mm-hmm. But they were also sins committed within our within our identity as the church, and the church has what's the word I'm looking for? We have a responsibility communally for our communal sins. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So I kind of have this like count of things I'm thinking up that you're making me think about here. The first is I've completely given up on editing. I'm not editing anything anymore.
Oh, great. So now all that rambling stays in.
Yeah. The second thing is, one thing that I thought was interesting in this article that it talked about was this idea of what past generations did in groups and what now people in those groups are doing now, and how we are not our fathers.
No.
We are not past generations. Yes, we have to deal, as you're saying, with the communal kind of things that the church may have embraced mm-hmm. back in those days. But just because, I mean, so, you know, it's saying back then the church was not at all behind the white church was not at all behind what King was doing. And now everyone in the white church is behind what King is doing. Well, was doing. But we are different people. We are different people that have a new way of looking at the world. And yes, we have to, I suppose we do bear some responsibility for what past generations have done, but
insofar as our identification with the church
sure
identifies us with their sin.
Yeah. But I hope that we have the opportunity and can make the most of the opportunity of being loving to those of disadvantaged circumstances, races.
So I wish you could, David, I wish you could talk a little bit about what you were saying the other day. So David and I just finished up a podcast about it's called History on Fire. The podcast name is called History on Fire, and they just finished up a number of episodes about an American African-American boxer who boxed at the same time period as H.P. Lovecraft at the turn of the century or the beginning of the 20th century. And he his name was Jack Johnson, not to be confused with our favorite surf acoustic guitar singer. and he had to go through all the things that you would expect somebody going through, you know, the 1920s and 30s.
Discrimination and
yeah. all those things. And David and I were kind of comparing notes as what we thought about this podcast. And David, at some point,
yeah.
what was it that you were saying about?
Yeah, no, I mean, absolutely. And this podcast just, this is something that really made me think, you know, it kind of two things came out of this, you know, just hearing what Jack Johnson had to go through, the same kind of thing, you know, that Jackie Robinson had to go through, all the abuse and
white boxers refusing to box against him.
Yep. Right. Yep.
Because
not being able to use hotel rooms
restaurants or just abuse and discrimination and white people doing horrible things just all the time. And that's it's so ugly and it's so sinful and it's so
right. Well, didn't you say disgusting. Like you just and it made you want to just apologize?
Yeah. So like, so there was this part of the story where he's having this big fight, and during the whole fight there's this white manager that's just screaming insults at him the whole time and talking about how he's just a brute and he's just all these horror. I mean, just the whole time. And he gets done and he wins and through the whole, it made me think.
I wish you guys could see David's face right now. He is physically in pain.
I feel like I should just go to a black person and say, I am so sorry for what white people have done to black people.
Yes.
This is just awful.
Yes.
And what a good impulse that is, but don't do that.
Right. That would be,
that's horrible
that
to do to someone.
Very rude.
Make them responsible
and,
for bearing, like, let me absolve you of your guilt, because it's not enough that, that your people have oppressed me. Now you're making me forgive you for it.
Right.
Publicly.
Yeah. It's ridiculous.
To make you feel better.
It's totally ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it also makes me wonder, and this is, I found myself, through listening to this story and the prevailing attitudes in the culture, I found myself wondering if I had grown up in the early 1900s in this Jim Crow South, mm-hmm. in the church as a white, I don't know, I guess not evangelical, but a white,
Southern Baptist
in the church, and as a product of the culture that believed that there should be this very natural separation between white and black, would I have...
Put some scare quotes around that word natural.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, totally.
It's really natural.
Natural. Would I have bought into that and defended that the way that seemingly all sorts of very decent, good Christians did?
More scare quotes.
I said seemingly, right?
Yeah.
Seemingly.
Okay.
Would I have...
Yeah, we have no way of knowing.
It's kind of a scary.
I'm going to disagree with that. I think we probably would.
That you would have gone along.
Yes. Okay. I think the probability is all three of us would be at. And here's the reason I say that for myself, and I'll be more honest than maybe I'm even comfortable with. But if I think back to my childhood, I remember feeling at times intimidated by the number of black football players on the field and feeling like, well, I mean, this is embarrassing to say it, but right. I'm just, well, the quarterbacks are always white. So we have a play like that must mean we have something going on. Like,
right.
Because I was afraid
right.
of what that might mean. Does that mean blacks are better than whites? Does that mean some people could be better than me?
Yeah.
And I was trying, and I don't know that that was, I didn't have, like, my parents weren't suggesting that or anything. I don't know where or how I filtered all of that out.
Well,
but you grew up
in a culture steeped in those kinds of anxieties.
Right.
So.
And I was, as a kid, wrestling with, you'll hear people, like now as an adult, I've heard people say back in, you know, the 50s and 60s and 70s, people would say, well, there'll never be a good black quarterback, or it will rarely happen because white quarterbacks have the intellect to pull this.
Oh,
and
my
goodness. As a kid, as an 8 or 9 or 10 year old kid, had the pieces. If somebody had said that to me, I could have easily latched onto that and ran with it as a kid because of my fears and because of whatever it is that just happens, the residual of white supremacy and the residual of racism that's been hardwired into our culture. And so it's embarrassing on one hand to say that, but I think that's my reality. And my suspicion is with the three of us growing up in the whitest state in America,
right.
chances are all three of us would be at some level of, we may not be, you know, Thomas Jefferson slave owners, but.
Well, I mean, we're probably not burning crosses, but on somebody's lawn, but we'd probably be the just quietly accepting, you know, this is normal and you don't engage. You don't make a fuss.
And how would we have reacted to Martin Luther King Jr., who is upsetting the apple cart?
Well, I mean...
Is that the right...
All we have to... That's a good metaphor.
Yeah, that metaphor works.
It works.
Where he's trying to come to the front of the bus and trying to sit in white-only diners.
He was literally breaking the law. So think about how controversial Colin Kaepernick's culturally unacceptable but perfectly legal protest is.
Right, exactly.
Like, it's not socially acceptable. So he's definitely being provocative, but he's not doing anything illegal. And Martin Luther King Jr. was literally breaking the law. So think how much more.
Even if it was a dumb law.
Well, horribly dumb law.
And, but as.
But it's the law. But and don't to, you want to be 19, a law abiding citizen, don't you?
Yeah. To like, to 1950s David, am I saying.
Well, but, okay. Well.
Would I say, well, you know, whatever, but we gotta keep the law. Like, we can't just ignore the law.
So
would I have said that?
Amanda, sometime we'll have to have the debate why you think it's okay to break the laws that are dumb laws for regarding racism, but it wasn't okay for American Christians to break off King George's bad laws on taxation without representation.
Ooh, this sounds fun.
Oh,
but we'll
we
do
could
that conversation
get into that one.
Coming up
next
time.
So,
preview,
you can,
the Imago
I like how you
Day
pick which laws you break
largely.
And which laws are dumb enough that you can break
oh, that
them.
That was just condescending enough.
Oh,
I love
know.
That.
I know.
Okay, so I think that statistically speaking, we're probably right. We're probably all complicit in the 1950s. I don't
totally
want
misrepresented your position on purpose there as any good
Donnybrooker
debater yeah. would do. So my apologies. Sort of.
Yeah, I'm good. We're good.
she's totally like not engaging.
I just want to tell a story. So I read a good book recently.
Again?
No jokes about that at all?
I know.
Come on. Are you just sick of making the same...
Another book, Amanda?
I had a very deja vu moment there. Sorry. I thought we were picking back up on the race ramble thing again.
The race ramble. Also, condescending again. My goodness. You are on a roll. All right.
Fired up.
The Fearless Benjamin Lay.
Never
heard of him.
Spelling, please. How do you spell Lay?
L-A-Y.
All right.
So the easy way.
Boring.
The Fearless Benjamin Lay, the Quaker dwarf who took up against the slave trade. So a friend of mine brought it home from the Smithsonian. I think she was visiting the Smithsonian and bought it in the bookstore there. And
that was my next question. She just brought it home from the Smithsonian.
Right. Pulled it right out of a display.
Just slipped that into her handbag and walked out. Like, how does that work? Okay, sorry.
Well, you know, not all of my friends are as reputable as you are.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Yeah.
The racist 9-year-old John. So continue.
Right. So it's about a 17th century Quaker named Benjamin Lay who railed against Quaker acceptance of slavery. So he grew up in England, was born and grew up in England. Then he worked as a sailor and eventually ended up in... Oh, I'm going to misquote, probably Dominican Republic or Barbados or one of the island nations that used slaves. Yes.
Oh. it's a Trump country.
Both John and David made the Trump joke there silently. One of those places where English planters used African slaves to work the sugar fields. And of course, it was the sugar trade that was so controversial in England when slavery was being debated at the end of the 18th century. But here's Benjamin Lay visiting these plantations late in the 17th century. And he was living there for a time. He'd been a sailor and was horrified by the treatment of the slaves on the plantations. Just utterly repulsed, refused to engage in trade with any of the planters, ended up living in abject poverty because he would not take the money of people who held slaves, did what he could.
I got to read this book.
Oh, it's so good.
This sounds awesome.
It sounds like it should be a movie.
It does sound like it should be a movie. I think it should be a movie.
But it would not have been written by H.P. Lovecraft.
No, not so much.
Okay.
So then he ends up coming back to England, and he's a Quaker, and Quaker meetings are characterized by the you're allowed to speak thing. Of course, there are authorized speakers that have more privileges for speaking. And he would interrupt all the meetings he could to condemn the fact that Quakers permitted slave owning.
Barbados.
Barbados. Okay. So I don't know about you, but I always thought of the Quakers as being pretty aggressively anti-slavery. But apparently that was a later development, and mm-hmm. it came after Benjamin Lay decided that it was his life's mission to make Quaker slave owners uncomfortable.
He's the Quaker Wilberforce, or?
Yeah, and, you know, dramatic. All about the street theater. So he showed up at a meeting, and he eventually moved to the Americas and lived in Pennsylvania.
Philadelphia.
And yeah, he shows up at a Quaker meeting, pulls a bladder filled with dark red juice out of a book, and then stabs it and sprays the juice over everyone and tells them it's the blood of the slaves that they own.
Whoa.
Denouncing them for their willingness to live on other men's blood. Then some time goes by. He's very – the Quakers are very unhappy with him.
That's the total prophetic spirit going on there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it sounds very Old Testament.
I have a very small handful of friends who would pull that kind of a stunt. Right? Like, I can think of two
or three
of them.
I don't think it's his best stunt. His best stunt comes some years later. He's living in a cave because he refuses to live off the labor of anyone else, grows most of his own food, is a vegetarian, will only wear clothes that he's made himself from spun flax.
Because likelihood is anything else that he buys at a store has been
touched by a slave.
Touched by a slave.
Yeah. Or is profiting a slave owner in some way. Mm-hmm. He has neighbors who are Quakers in good standing in the local Quaker meeting, and they own a slave girl. And he goes to dinner at their house and argues with them about the fact that they have basically kidnapped her from her family and that they are guilty of her parents' grief by owning her. They refuse to listen to him. And so he walks out refusing to eat the food because it was prepared by slave hands. Fun guest. A couple days later, he sees their son, who's about 7 years old, wandering around playing on the road, invites him to his house, and keeps him entertained in his house cave all day long while he hears the search parties going out looking for the boy who's now missing. So he kidnaps the boy, you know, benevolently.
Yeah.
Keeps him in the house, entertains him with food and drink and books, tells him to stay inside, leaves him with cakes or something, goes out and
Turkish delight.
Turkish delight.
It's vegetarian.
Very good.
Cake, so vegetarian. How good could it be?
Well, Turkish delight is vegetarian-ish. Yeah, totally. No, it's gelatin. Never mind. It's not vegetarian.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Okay.
And then he goes and he just happens to bump into their parents and he's like, "What's going on? You seem upset." And they're like, "Our son is missing. We can't find him." And he's like, "Oh, that sounds horrible. Like maybe your slave's parents felt."
Mm-hmm.
"Oh, I have your kid."
Yeah.
So.
Wow.
Anyway, by the time of his death, the Quaker meeting, the Quakers had met together. Their general council or whatever they have annually had agreed that no Quaker could purchase a slave. And then a few years later, they determined that you could not be a Quaker in good standing if you owned a slave. And they became known for their opposition to slavery. So,
interesting.
You know, slavery died out like that in England, too, didn't it? It was kind of by degrees.
It was by degrees, yes.
Not in America.
And through the legal system. It was gradually made illegal.
America was so ugly and bloody, it was right away. But, I mean, not the atrocities of Jim Crow and all that, but slavery was legal one day and illegal the next day because of the Civil War and how terrible that was. But I wonder, I always equate abortion with slavery and the struggle against abortion and as kind of a slavery type thing. And I wonder if abortion is ever outlawed in this country, if it's by degrees in the same way.
As slavery became illegal in England.
Yeah. I wonder. Interesting. Well, my goodness, hasn't this just been a rollicking, joyous conversation?
Really, we are talking about cheery things.
Bitcoin and H.P. Lovecraft and ending with slavery.
Yeah, going from the great old ones.
Yeah.
And their cryptocurrency.
John, do you have any happy music to buoy our spirits?
I don't have anything handy, but if you could just kill a couple minutes, I have a good way of finishing.
Could we kill a couple of minutes?
Well, I thought it would be worth revisiting, at least momentarily. We had talked about holidays in our last podcast. Now we're past the holidays. We experienced them. What were the highlights of the holiday season, Christmas, New Year's, etc., for you guys?
Well, I'll tell you, I had so much fun on Christmas Eve. We had snowed all night long. It was so fun sitting there looking out the window at the snow coming down. And on Christmas Eve, it was very stereotypically wonderful.
That sounds great.
We had family in town and had a great time with family and just a nice time. I made twice baked potatoes on Christmas Day.
Yum.
And it was kind of amazing.
That does sound good.
I kind of want to make them again right now.
Well, you know, if you ever brought twice baked potatoes to podcasting, I would never turn them down.
Maybe we should have twice baked potatoes at the next podcast. That would be good, wouldn't
it? I like this idea in our new studio.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like it.
I'm a little disappointed, though, because I thought you'd mention the fact that over the holidays, we had all three of our families together twice. In the the two of us who have very small houses hosted dinners at two different times where John's family and his five children and David's family and his five children and my much smaller family all under one
roof.
Two
children.
Oh, I think we made it three times.
Was
well,
it three
it wasn't,
times?
Wasn't all the families, but we had...
We didn't have the families at your house. It was
right.
Adults only at your house, which had its own delights.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But we had kind fun. Of a raucous dinner.
There are a lot of people around when we get all of our families together.
Right?
There's like, what, 20 people? Is it 20?
I think it's 18.
Five?
18?
Seven? Yeah, you each
18.
Have families of yeah. seven and I have
it's
a family 18. Of four. Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah, 18 people. I mean, it might as well be 20, I guess, at that point.
Well, around it feels
I mean,
like 20.
One of yours is as loud as any three, so.
Right. It feels like 20.
It's 20. We're going to surround it. David has an announcement he'd like to make. Second set of twins.
Oh,
in 2018. Ladies and gentlemen, he's going to seven and a 12-passenger bus.
Fake news.
Fake news. Fake news.
That's
fake
a little news. 2018 joke for you there.
Oh, we are so hip and with
2017
it.
Joke, isn't it? Wasn't 2017
the year? 2017
was
the year,
yeah, was the year 2017.
Of fake news.
You're going backwards. So I was thinking about this so theologically or good understanding of Scripture would have let Christians know in a lot of different ways that racism is wrong. And
good understanding of Scripture along with a willingness to reject their immediate prophet.
Yes. Yeah, which is also a good understanding of Scripture.
Which goes along with a good understanding of
which
Scripture.
Which is, blessed are the poor.
Yes.
Blessed are the poor. But in Revelation 21, it talks about, this is the chapter talking about New Jerusalem and the new creation of how we're ultimately how we're going to spend our eternity with Christ. And in verse 22, it says, let's actually pick it up in 23. The city does not need the sun or the moon to shine because God's glory illuminates it and its lamp is the Lamb. And then 24 is awesome. And I think it speaks to the variety of peoples or tribes or nations or races, and the nations will walk in its light, and the kings of earth will bring their glory into it. And you understand as you read that, I don't think it's too much to say there's a distinctiveness between right. those different nations mm-hmm. and those different kings. Each of those kings, each of those nations, it appears, has a type of glory, a value that they bring that is unique. And we as Christians should be embracing that glory and bringing about unity, not division, and mm-hmm. and welcoming that variety. And I think I've heard a lot of white evangelicals talk about how impactful the expression of black church music or black worship is, and how we just stand in our pews and can hardly clap. And we wish we could.
We don't have that glory.
We don't have that glory. We don't have that glory. But our brothers and sisters do. And there are other things that we can't just limit it to. Well, they have something to offer. We'll give them this little piece.
Right.
The black community, the black church has a ton to offer if we can just lay down our pride and
see the image of God.
And see the image of God.
Right.
Yeah. I know we're trying to wrap this up, but I remembered the other part of what I was thinking about when I was thinking about,
right,
I'm looking at 1950s David and thinking, wow, am I there? And so it makes me think, if I were to look back on now, 50 years from now, I'm being optimistic here, 50 years, I'll
right.
still be around. And is there anything culturally that I just accepted as part of the church culture or the culture at large, and that I would look back and say, wow, I can't believe I thought that was kind of crazy. Obviously, the first thing that comes to mind is the big thing that everyone's arguing about now, which is the LGBT issue, which I'm not changing my mind on that or saying that that's something that I'm going to have a revelation around.
180 degree turn on.
Right. I'm not going to go all Eugene Peterson on us here. But
oh my goodness.
Who's flip-flopped twice in 24 hours.
But I would say that's something that I think a lot of people are thinking about.
Right. Well, and there's been deliberate framing of that issue within the same context.
Exactly.
But
it's not the same thing.
No, but there are going to be things where maybe your theology won't change fundamentally, but that your approach or perspective or emphasis might, right? I don't know. John was very open about, you know, his racist 9-year-old self. I can't even distance myself from this. I think 37-year-old me, I definitely am profoundly materialistic. And I think that that is one of, if not the besetting sin of the modern American church. And I have been formed in that image. And I think I'm beginning to become dimly aware of that deficiency. And so thinking about how love of things over love of people, love of things over love of community. Yeah. I don't know. That's the first thing that came to mind when you were talking about that. Like, yeah. I'm going to look back in 50 years and be like, yes, you had no idea how accepting you all were. We all were. Our whole church was, and that church and all of us together were so accepting of materialistic
stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, stuff, yeah, and the accumulation of stuff and the privileging of stuff. But
this is what we've been listening to at our house, and it seems appropriate because this is the other person who's been doing a lot of music for he's been doing a lot of music and has gotten a lot of criticism for his position on race issues within the Christian church.
Lecrae?
That's Lecrae.
Yeah.
You better tell me if you're with me. I know the devil trying to stop me. Got these people out here wishing they could pop me. If they want me, come and get me. Man, I ain't scared of none of y'all. The only thing I fear, the IRS and God. If you want me, go against me. Nah, they probably better think twice. Got angels over my head, war on my mind. If you want me, come and get me. Well, y'all might as well go ahead.
Well, I like him more than Kendrick Lamar.
I don't know how to respond to that. So I <don't either. laughs>
All righty. Well, we probably better wrap it up here, but thanks so much for coming and hanging out. This was fun. I'm looking forward to doing it again. Let's not wait another month and a half.
Sounds good.
I'm David.
I'm Amanda.
And I'm John.
See you next time.